I'm Dan Runcie, this is Trapital, and we're going to talk all about YouTube, the platform whose dominance starts to feel a little bit more inevitable every year. YouTube has reached what I like to call a zenith in social media, and that's when you start to become a bit of a competitor to everyone, even companies that you may not traditionally think of. Let's look into obvious areas like video, all of those SVOD services like Netflix, Max, Disney+, Amazon Prime Video. They're all competing for the attention of viewership that YouTube has, which continues to grow, but they're also competing for advertisers and the relationships and the strength of the business that YouTube has had for quite some time that a lot of those companies are much earlier on. If we shift gears slightly to music, look at Spotify. Look at a lot of the new features that Spotify has put more effort in. Video and podcasting, video on music. A lot of those are things that YouTube has done quite well. And if we shift gears again slightly over to short form video, specifically in music, look at what TikTok is doing and look at what YouTube Shorts are doing. And a lot of those products look similar and the usage is starting to grow quite a bit as well. And when we take a step back and look at all aspects of social media, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, you name it, everyone is competing for attention and a lot more of that attention is going to YouTube. So it's a great opportunity as you kick off 2025 to talk about where YouTube's strategy sits today, what some of its challenges and vulnerabilities are, and where things are moving forward. I'm joined by Tati Sirsano from Media Research, so I hope you enjoy this one. This episode of Trapital is presented by State Farm. When you start a new business, your first reaction might be to say, woohoo, yes, or booyah. But one thing to say that could be a huge help is, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, State Farm will be there with the coverage that fits your need, whether your business is growing or just open its doors. State Farm agents are small business owners too, so they know what it takes. They can help you create an insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. And when you need help, State Farm is there to answer your small business questions or help you file a claim and get you back in business. With State Farm, you can worry less about the unexpected and focus more on your business. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is helping you achieve your goals. And just say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Let's dive in. All right, we're back with another episode of Trapital. We have Tati Sirsano from Media Research with us again, and we're going to dive into YouTube. This was the year that YouTube announced that it wanted to surpass Spotify as the number one contributor of revenue to the music industry. Spotify had shared that in the calendar year 2023, it contributed $9 billion. YouTube had shared that it had contributed $6 billion, although it was July of 2022 up until June of 2023. So not exactly an even comparison. But do we think a year from now, looking back at things, that YouTube will surpass Spotify as the number one contributor for revenue in the industry?
Juicy. I love it. It's really hard, as you mentioned, to predict and to compare because we haven't gotten a number from YouTube in a couple of years now. But I do feel like it's inevitable for YouTube to surpass Spotify. It's not just how much they are paying to the music industry now, but how much room there is to grow. I think that YouTube is in a really good position. I feel like it sometimes is lost or just forgotten how massive YouTube is as a form of music consumption, because based on our consumer surveys, watching music videos through YouTube is the number one most popular way to consume music globally, like full stop. And then when it comes to Spotify, even though Spotify is the leading streaming service by subscription market share, that position is around a third of the market globally. So even though Spotify is dominant, it's not all dominant. It's not all encompassing. And I think sometimes from where we sit, you in California, me in New York, and in the Western music industry, it can feel like it's more dominant globally than it is. I think there's also a couple of reasons that are more about Spotify's weaknesses than they are about YouTube's strengths. Some of those are Spotify being much more reliant on subscriptions, and streaming subscription revenue growth is slowing. So of course that's going to affect both of them, but maybe will drag down Spotify's growth potential more than YouTube's. I think Spotify, all music platforms would love to be paying less to music rights holders if they could. But I think Spotify in particular seems to be actively, and some have argued aggressively, trying to reduce the share of revenue that pays to rights holders. So while that's happening on Spotify, YouTube is the opposite, screaming from the rooftops, we want to be paying more. YouTube also has the benefit of being part of Google, part of Alphabet, they can afford to lose money on music. Not that we want music to be a loss leader, but if we're talking about strengths and weaknesses, that's another point for YouTube. Finally, the most important point in terms of growth and where the industry is going is that YouTube hosts and monetizes many more music formats than Spotify. In addition to audio tracks and official music videos, there's short form video, long form video, there's live videos, there's performance videos, there's remixes, there's UGC. And YouTube has been really open about how much more important UGC content is becoming to the revenue that pays out to the music industry. The last time that they released those figures, they said it was about 30%, which would have been just under $2 billion. All signs are pointing to it continuing to grow. And that's something that Spotify doesn't have, and I don't know if they ever will.
Let's talk about that last point specifically, because another area YouTube does well is playlists. They'll put together a string of artist playlists themselves and have that just as a continual thread to play. And of course, Spotify has playlists, but it still is packaging that same exact unit of that song into something, versus with YouTube, because it is a brand new video, you are creating something that is entirely new. And you're starting to see different artists have some of their songs packaged together as particular moods and having that be something that you can just play in the background, or artists putting their stuff on loops. One of our daughters loves Gracie's Corner. And sure, there's individual songs and music videos on YouTube, but they do just have the hour-long playlists. And if you're having young kids, you just want to have something that can play and sit there. And it does a good job of that. A lot of that stuff has lived in the UGC worlds of YouTube, but artists are starting to do more of this themselves too, under second, third channels.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I can't think of another platform of YouTube scale that has both types of content, UGC content and professional releases.
Not to that level. There's a interpretation of Amazon Prime Video, where if you look deep within the depths of that, you may find some very random stuff.
I have not been in those depths.
When you have time, you can look for the show or movie you're trying to find. But then if you just scroll through and look a few rows and you find some of the lookalike content or some of the other things that have been made by semi-professionals or amateurs, you start to see some of these types of areas. I think SoundCloud can serve this purpose for a lot of independent creators around the world, but not to the same level of scale as YouTube.
I feel like YouTube, whether it was strategic or whether some of it just right timing, is in a really good position right now for those reasons. Audiences are wanting a place where these types of content can coexist. It's a platform that captures both passive attention and active attention, which on Spotify, you play something, minimize it, and continue what you were doing. Whereas YouTube is a place where you can have that experience, but you can also, and many people do, have the experience of actively spending time on that platform.
This company is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year and continues to grow and evolve in so many ways. YouTube has just been this like slow, steady truck that just grows and grows. No different than how you and I may talk about these artists that are these 10-year overnight success stories. That also speaks to just all of the different types of companies that look at YouTube as a competitor. If you are trying to be a major player in podcasting, you're looking at YouTube as a competitor because they are a place where people are going to watch and sometimes listen to their podcast and put them on the biggest screens in their houses. If you are in music, you are competing with this platform, even if you're trying to maximize subscriptions from everywhere else. If you are a SVOD company like Netflix or others, you are competing against YouTube because they have the advertiser relationships. They have the attention. If you're TikTok, you're competing against YouTube. So everywhere you look in the media entertainment landscape, this company is right there.
Video is now the core of everything. Music is deeply tied to video. Podcasting is now video. Gaming is now video. Everything has started to revolve around a video component. So YouTube is in the perfect position to create this ecosystem with all those formats.
Quick sidebar on the video podcast part, because there was a lot of talk this past year, especially with everything around the election and trends of certain podcasters that have invested much more into video. This is a MTV moment for podcasting where there's now a lot of conversations I'm hearing from podcasters that have been going back and forth about, oh, I had been perfecting my audio for all this time, making sure that it is in top shape, making sure that people can listen and really appreciate the words. And now if I need to create content that can go viral or be a clip, I feel like I'm being turned into a pony that needs to be focused on that, as opposed to being able to immerse yourself in a 45-minute podcast. This is the same type of stuff that people have said in music for years about how they complained about MTV 40 years ago. It's what they said about TikTok 5-6 years ago. There's definitely some frustrations about your content be atomized, but this is where things are going. You can see the trends happening in music before we see them everywhere else. I don't think this is something that goes in reverse.
I think we're seeing a decoupling of stories from formats. The same story, whether it's a song, a podcast, an audiobook, a game, a movie, a real book, can be told in all those formats. For the consumer, you pick which one is your preferred, and maybe just your preferred at that given time of day or that activity that you're doing or whatever it is. And YouTube is in the position of sitting in the space that like all of those things are collapsing onto, which is video. I think there's a wider trend happening where format isn't necessarily the guiding determinant of how a story is told. It can be told across all formats.
That flexibility speaks to how artists and creators make money on the platform. Something that you've talked about on past episodes that we should probably talk more about here is how artists look at monetization specifically on YouTube, because as all of these trends that we've been talking about continue to evolve, that piece continues to evolve too.
Exactly. All of these creators who are deciding, okay, I'm never really going to make meaningful income on streaming, so let me just try and focus on building a career on YouTube. That revenue is being paid out to artists, but it's not included in the money that YouTube pays out to recorded music rights holders. There's a growing number of them, I would say, who are opting to build careers more akin to content creators than musicians, because they're finding it's actually easier to build a business on YouTube than on Spotify. And with more and more music creators trying to build careers around like smaller engaged fan bases rather than trying to scale and win the streaming game, YouTube provides a lot of tools to do that. I was listening at the Music Tectonics conference to Ricky Chinez, a music creator and YouTuber, talk about his career. And he was saying, if you have 1,000 subscribers to your YouTube channel, you can make a decent amount of money off of that. If you have 1,000 listeners on your Spotify track, you don't meet the earnings threshold. And obviously that's kind of apples to oranges, but I think YouTube is providing monetization pathways to do that, and Spotify just isn't.
And speaking about apples to oranges comparisons, we should talk about the number of subscribers. YouTube had announced about a year ago, this is February 2024, that they had over 100 million paid subscribers that were either using its YouTube Premium product or its YouTube Music product. YouTube hasn't split those numbers, so we don't know how many are subscribed to one versus the other, but it's important to note that YouTube Premium does cost a few dollars more. Maybe it was like $2 or $3 more, at least in developed markets or here in the US. And that also includes the subscription to YouTube Music as well. We don't know what that split is. We do know that there's been other stats that have come through in 2021, when Rob Kinstel, the current CEO of Warner Music Group, was chief business officer at YouTube, he had said that around 25% of the watch time for content on YouTube was dedicated to music, and 25% came from traditional media companies, and 50% was user-generated content. Even that is probably a tough benchmark to use if you're really trying to split up who would be subscribed to one of these services than the others. But that 25% number is the one that I've always kept in mind when I think about content length and also how much people are watching music versus non-music on YouTube.
One of the things we talked about is whether that percentage has changed, because we don't have updated data. I feel like it's likely lower than that. In one of our consumer surveys a year ago, we asked people, what type of content do you mainly watch on YouTube? They could select up to 2 options. Music was number one for the average consumer with 46%. And this is a global survey, not specifically music videos, just music. The second most popular was comedy, which was at 31%. And then tutorials were at 23%. But then when we compared that to the youngest age group, 16 to 19s, comedy was actually number one at 47%, followed by video games, which was not even in the top 5 ranking for the average consumer, video games at 46%, and then music at 24%. So we are seeing this trend where younger audiences might be using YouTube for music less. And that is something to keep an eye on, where we can talk about, like, what are the weaknesses or vulnerabilities or challenges to YouTube? We talked about this in the music videos episode, how there's been this sort of decline of the music video in, like, cultural weight, I guess you could say, as users' own videos using music are becoming more important. There's more content on YouTube than ever, more niches, tutorials, gaming videos, all these sorts of things. So just the attention economy is another factor. But also, there's this whole thing we haven't talked about yet with music sort of being at a disadvantage on YouTube. Videos tend to be shorter because the format is shorter, right? The songs are 3 minutes or so. Whereas you look at some of these gaming videos, or you look at certain content creators, and comedy videos can be 20, 30 minutes longer. So even if the view counts on music videos might be really high, the time spent with them is lower. In terms of Robert Kinsel, the quote of the 25%, I wonder if we could know that today, maybe a bit lower, around the same, but I'm not confident it would be higher. What do you think?
I would generally agree that I think it's probably lower. One question that I did have for you, when you say comedy, is comedy watching stand-up bits, or is it watching like goofy people doing funny things, or do they also encounter like Theo Von, who is a comedian, or Joe Rogan, who is technically a comedian, doing podcast interviews?
The latter. So it would be not so much stand-up videos, but more the accounts that are posting funny videos and comedians, content creators who have big followings and things like that.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Let's take a break for our chart metric stat of the week. We got to give credit where credit's due, because LiAngelo Ball may not have made it in the league the way that his two other brothers did, but he is the only Ball brother that recorded a certified hit. On January 3rd, LiAngelo, who goes by G3 Jello, dropped Tweaker. And this song gives you that Cash Money Records, Manny Fresh Production vibe. And in my circles of social media, I keep seeing that first line. I might swerve in that corner, whoa. Everywhere that I turn. And this is an independent release. This is from Born to Ball Records. You know how the Ball family does. Big baller brand was the shoes. They have the record label. So shout out to Jello. Shout out to Lonzo, who's credited as a songwriter on this song. We know that there are plenty of NBA players who have dipped their toes in hip hop and released music. I don't think most of it's good, so I gotta give credit where I think it's due. Shout out Jello, listen to Tweaker if you haven't heard it yet. Let's get back to the episode. The most watched videos on YouTube are often the music videos themselves, but 3 minute video is different than the 3 hour video. The Cat Williams interview with Shannon Sharp on Club Shay Shay, Shannon Sharp said he made a ton of money from that thing, went huge and viral. Less than 100 million views on YouTube for the full 2 hour and 46 minute video is 86 million. If a Dua Lipa music video gets 86 million views, they consider that a flop. And in general, because of the trends of how YouTube works, I think we've seen artists just put less emphasis, relatively speaking, into their music videos. Of course, we're a long ways away from the CD era where they were literally putting everything into these multi-million dollar music videos. But we're also a long way too from Beyonce doing visual albums. We didn't get any music videos from Renaissance. We didn't get any music videos really from Cowboy Carter. Part of that's also just reading the room and reading the economics. And yeah, there's just less incentive to do that today in 2025 than there was to do it even in 2015.
YouTube in music industry strategy should be not just about how much more can YouTube pay us, but also how can we rethink the way we approach YouTube as artists. Instead of releasing music videos as a mass market thing, they really should be for the super fans. If music videos aren't a thing people watch on MTV casually anymore, they can be 10 minutes long and we can invest more into it, and there can be more valuable ads inserted in that and things like that. It's not just about this conversation of how can we get YouTube to surpass Spotify and become the top contributor of music industry revenue. Is also about how can the music industry use YouTube better. The YouTube strategy of 5 years ago is not working the same in today's environment.
And if you ask the leaders in the music industry how they can get more out of YouTube, their answer, it seems like now, would be to start charging more for it.
Yes.
Last year, Sony Great Music segue. CEO Rob Stringer had said that he wanted to see a modest fee attached to the music that you can freely consume on ad-supported services. To be clear, he did not specify Spotify or YouTube, but both Spotify and YouTube, the two largest platforms for music, also have free tiers. There's a larger percentage of Spotify's users that are converted to paid as opposed to YouTube's users that are converted to paid. I think a lot of people look at Netflix adding a discounted tier that includes ads as a way that they were able to capture some more money, build relationships with advertisers, and that worked with that business. But the distinction is that the content on Netflix was not available freely elsewhere. So it wasn't like you were taking something away and then putting a price tag on it. That is what's happening now. If you are starting from scratch, is this something that should be paid for? Of course it should be paid for. You have access to all the greatest music in the world and you can do it freely by just going to whatever website and typing in a few searches and being able to hear it in full instantly as long as you just listen to or watch a few ads. But now that people have gotten used to consumer behavior, that's the bigger rub. How do you change consumer behavior at this stage in the game? And I could see it being a little bit tough, even in the developed markets, which is where they want to potentially push for these changes.
I totally agree. It's tough. As much as I would love for the ad-supported tier even to be something you have to pay for, because I think music has value and we should be pricing it accordingly. But I agree with you. I think it's hard to go back now. And it's tough because there is the same content available across these different platforms and consumers could just switch and go elsewhere. Like, I can't really see YouTube adding a price to the ad-supported tier because advertising is its whole business. It's selling access to audiences. And I think there would be a fear that audience would shrink and negatively affect them in that way. And then if Spotify did it, its ad-supported users would just go to YouTube. I think it would be really hard to get off the ground as much as I would love to see it. But I do agree with Stringer's follow-up comments on that we do as an industry need to make ad-supported work better for us and not be simply a funnel and not be simply something that is an intentionally irritating experience because you want people to go onto subscriptions, especially as we reach a point where there's a lot of people who just are never going to pay a subscription, but maybe there's a way to get more value out of that. So I know people have brought up serving more ads to people. I think that sounds horrible, but maybe there's an advertising light tier is something that's also been proposed where maybe you pay $1.99 for a lighter ad load or something like that. So I do agree that we need to, this is a good moment to rethink ad supported, but I don't know if adding a modest fee would work.
Yeah, there could be something to that last suggestion of creating more ads on the current version. And can you create enough friction to add, to get people to want to pay for the product itself? You saw Spotify do this to some extent where if you add Spotify on the mobile app, you could not select individual songs the way that you could. You just had to let it play. And if you wanted to have that feature on mobile, you had to pay for it. So yeah, is there some type of advertising light option that could make it more enjoyable in that type of way? That could be interesting. But then again, yeah, it does just rub against where things have been for so long with this. And with this conversation specifically, who is the persona of the type of person that is targeted for these type of services, whether it is YouTube Premium or others? Because yes, I do subscribe to a DSP. I do use Spotify. Remind me, which one do you use?
Spotify.
Do you currently pay for YouTube Premium or YouTube?
No, I don't.
Okay.
But I will say I'm considering it.
You're considering
so
it?
So maybe I'm one of these people.
Do you do YouTube TV like for cable or?
No, I don't.
Okay. I don't do it either. I've done it in the past, but I don't do it right now. Do you watch YouTube on your TV, like through the app?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. I would consider getting a paid version of it to not have to watch ads for that specifically.
Yeah. I don't know why I have it. And this is a funny analyzing myself as a consumer in this. I don't really know why I have it. Maybe it's just laziness. Maybe it's just subscription fatigue. It's not that much money. I'm just annoyed at the idea of having to pay for another subscription on top of everything that I already pay for. But I don't know. I haven't done it yet.
I probably will eventually. And similarly, I haven't done it yet. But I have found myself watching more and more. When I really started to see a trend was when people would send me pictures that they took of having this podcast specifically, watching it on YouTube, having it up on the screen. I'm in your living room right now, and you're hearing me talk about B2B entertainment companies. Okay. All right.
On the big screen.
So I know that obviously I'm a unique case, but I know that I'm not alone in someone that has continued to spend more and more time on YouTube and frankly, less and less time on some of the other traditional SVOD services or just other types of platforms where I am listening to things. And I know that YouTube has made some specific headways and improvements to try to improve that particular product as well, creating episodic playlists the same way that they exist when you go into Netflix and you want to watch a show and you can see all of the episodes that are there, or trailers that automatically play when you hover over a particular tile on the screen. I probably will do a subscription at some point. It probably at this stage wouldn't be to replace Spotify, but again, I may not be the target audience.
That also reminds me, despite YouTube having this great ecosystem of all these different apps you can use together, like toggling between YouTube and YouTube Music videos and YouTube Music, the audiences still seem to be, based on our data, pretty siloed. There's a lot of people that probably have YouTube Premium but are still regularly using Spotify, even though YouTube Premium includes YouTube Music. So I think that there is more potential to like better connect those pieces of the flywheel. I'll give you what I thought was the weirdest example. 31% of consumers are weekly active users of YouTube Shorts and 44% of YouTube for Music videos, but only 18% are weekly active users of both. And that's despite the fact that you can only access Shorts from within the YouTube app. And both have similar age distributions when you look at the weekly active users. So you would think that people would be using both in tandem, but only 18% are.
All right. So even in the own app, when it's just one tab that you would press to go over to the other, it is a completely different type of user experience in that way.
Yeah, which is fascinating. And maybe also just speaks to the wide range of people and niches and subcultures on YouTube and how there's a very different like community culture in all those niches.
Right. I was talking to someone about this the other day. We were talking about Facebook specifically and how like 10, 12 years ago, that was peak time for Candy Crush. Now Candy Crush was everywhere. People would always go on Facebook to use that. But I was someone that at least at that stage was still going on Facebook every day. Never once played any of those games. Now, I'm not saying that as a point of pride, to be clear. I just did not happen to. I knew a lot of people that did. I'm sure there's people that actively use those apps, but didn't scroll through and do any of the other stuff that I was doing on Facebook at the time either. Once these apps become so large and massive, you use that app for that? Oh, interesting. I don't use that. Twitter kind of had a little bit of that where some people were active in Spaces at one point. Some people do use Grok, which is their AI text to image generator, and others just don't, right? A majority of them don't, at least as it lives right now.
This is also really interesting from the perspective of how YouTube balances YouTube Shorts and YouTube proper, because if there are all these people who are using Shorts and not really engaging with YouTube, still YouTube's product and YouTube needs to compete in short form. So it's not a bad thing, but I would think that YouTube doesn't necessarily want Shorts to become more popular than YouTube because the ad monetization there isn't as good. So it's this interesting position of YouTube having almost competition between its own apps and having to balance the revenue that each of those brings in and make sure that they're complementing each other rather than one cannibalizing the other.
Because ideally, you would want there to be some type of funnel of adoption, and you're able to capture some of that attention that the YouTube execs would say doesn't go anywhere if you're on other platforms, implying TikTok. Right. But it's also tough because if you didn't have YouTube Shorts, then would you have this attention anyway? That does remind me of Facebook and Instagram, where at one point, Facebook just did a better job of monetizing as opposed to Instagram did, at least for time and viewership and people actively using the platform. So I feel like this is almost feels like a rite of passage for social media evolution.
Even though we would sit here and say Instagram is, of course, the more, you know, dominant app because culturally it is, Facebook is still immensely popular. YouTube doesn't have anything to worry about right now with this, but I think it is something that needs to be balanced, how to have all of these of the ecosystem contributing.
So you would say this is a bug, not a feature.
Is it a bug or is it a feature that it has all these different things?
I lean more towards feature because I think they prefer more of the in-house competition. We'd rather be the ones that are winning it than someone that doesn't live in this house. I think about record labels. A lot of them are part of the same label group. They're still competing, right? I think about publications that are all owned by the same media corporation. They all have journalists that are competing for scoops, but they all pretty much report to the same person. There's an aspect of this with YouTube specifically, as there is with Meta and as there is with others.
Yes. I wanted to point out that YouTube has that position of having to have these competing apps within its ecosystem. But the fact that it is an ecosystem in the first place is still one of its biggest advantages as a company. So it's definitely, yes, more of a feature than a bug, but it doesn't come without this sort of those sort of caveats.
And with that, we should talk about some of the potential drawbacks or vulnerabilities for YouTube's current position and where we see it moving forward. Obviously, we've talked about a lot of the strength. I think that YouTube's inevitability feels like a common thread with a lot of this, but no strategy is perfect. Where are the holes? Where are the areas that they can either lose out, whether it's from the users, whether it's from the competitors, the advertisers, any of the various business partners that are relying on this ecosystem to do its thing? I think that the way that paid and advertising adoption has continued to go, you're just going to continue to need massive scale in order for it to work in that way. Yeah. I do think that monetizing short form video in general can be a challenge. You really need the massive volume, and sometimes the advertising dollars don't necessarily come there. A second one is YouTube does still compete with Netflix and Max and Disney Plus, and even though those companies are also trying to compete with Netflix and advertising, YouTube had tried to compete with those companies and it didn't exactly work, which is why they pulled back from some of their originals. It feels inevitable that it's going to come back. But when it does, can they capture the zeitgeist of a Netflix show? And then the third one, a potential TikTok ban, if it does happen, I'm still skeptical, but if it does happen and it is enforced, could probably be a benefit to YouTube, at least in the US. I do think that some of the other administration potential changes like content moderation could be things that can be a challenge again down the road. A lot of companies specifically have pivoted the way that their wind blows based on the results of the 2024 election. We saw that with Meta. We talked a little bit about that earlier. This can be a big thing for YouTube as well. Where does that quote unquote restoring free speech narrative that we keep on hearing line itself up with some of the takedowns they had on Alex Jones, InfoWars, and some of that stuff? Are we potentially re-entering some of those challenges and then having this broader debate just end up being sticky in a type of way and could be potentially harmful for the platform? Because there were definitely times where YouTube had tried to navigate those waters and there were some public PR backlash that happened as a result. But those are some of the challenges I could see in the future.
Yeah, I think those are all super valid. And it's good that you brought up the regulation piece. There's also the element of already this happening like in the EU, where there's been calls to limit social media use for different age groups and things like that. Even outside of the regulatory framework, we're also seeing the start of consumer backlash to spending so much time on screens. I remain unconvinced that that will actually have a big impact just because it's too much a part of our lives. There are a lot of benefits to the platforms that we have available. And I think we're all addicted for better or for worse.
Yeah. In terms of consumers trying to spend less time on screens, this is the first generation of really young people that are being raised on truly trying to limit their online screen time and YouTube watching and viewing. And yes, we know so much of that's common, but I hear parents complain even about how YouTube for kids isn't limiting enough in that type of way, or they'll complain about, you know, Paw Patrol and just either whether it's some of the content or some of the eccentric colors and just how addictive that type of content can feel in a way where it probably wouldn't be something you would normally see, at least were things that like you and I may have grown up with on, you know, Disney or Nickelodeon or Fox Kids or whatever it may be. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they navigate all of that.
Exactly. Like just the way that the phrase iPad kid has become part of our lexicon says it all.
Right. I feel like I am just punting the time frame where I'm on a plane and I can't keep this kid occupied. So let me just give them an iPad for them to sit in front of for hours on end. I'm a 2.5-year-old and I haven't done it yet. Right. But I'd be surprised if a year from now that I am not doing that, just because that's kind of the way these things go.
But the clock's ticking.
The clock is ticking. And I'm sure we will revisit this sooner rather than later. But Tati, thanks again for coming on and joining us.
Of course. Happy New Year, Dan.
Happy New Year. And that's it for YouTube. I am sure we will be revisiting this topic soon enough. Thanks again to Tati for joining us. Thanks again to our editors and producers for making this episode possible. And if you want to hear more on YouTube, I do suggest you to go back and listen to the episode that Tati and I did towards the end of 2023. It was a 20-year breakdown on everything YouTube did up to this point, its relationship with music, record labels, and more. Again, if this is your topic, this is your wheelhouse, I think you'll really enjoy that historical deep dive. It's an evergreen episode. It'll be just as more relevant as YouTube continues to grow and evolve as a platform. Hope you enjoy. We'll be back next week with another episode. Talk soon.